Now, I remember I went to a training that you did a couple of years ago with Bob Boyle, and I remember the advice, do not say anything, even sometimes admitting your address or your name.
Is it in the grand jury?
Is it true that somehow that could be manipulated, that one really shouldn't say anything?
Well, there is the potential of waiving. If you say something, you could waive your Fifth Amendment right by already participating in the conversation. So if you talk, then you might lose the ability to assert your Fifth Amendment and go through the immunity process.
So, Margaret, what's at stake now with these various people in Chicago and Minneapolis being subpoenaed to the grand jury, the FBI going into their homes and taking their BlackBerries and their computers and their records and everything? What's going on?
Well, I think it's kind of really interesting what's going on. I mean, it really represents the tremendous sea change we have in this country in terms of the ability of people to actively oppose this government's policy. This is a situation that if it happened in 1983, for example, with the groups that were opposing the U.S. intervention in Central America and the propping up of various dictators, there were many groups in this country who were joining forces with the progressive groups in Central America and aiding them in various ways. You had the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. You had people working with the Nicaraguans. You had a whole host of progressive people supporting the progressive movements in Central America. Now, if that happened today, these people would be subject to, as the people who have been subpoenaed to these grand juries, would be subject to very serious criminal actions against them based on the Patriot Act that now is in existence. I'm sure that this audience has heard about the material aid situation that's happening in this country today.
Materially aiding terrorism, supposedly.
Right. Terrorists are anybody the government designates as a terrorist.
And certainly, for example, the FALN would have been designated terrorist in 1983, and the people who worked in support of the people of El Salvador would have been in the same situation that the people who have been served with subpoenas today are in. It shows you that the FBI was so frustrated by their inability to really do anything against the CISPIS people. I mean, what they did was kind of COINTELPRO because they had no laws to back them up. So they did illegal things against these people to shut them up. They went to their offices, they talked to their employers, they talked to their families, but there was really very little they could do. The worst they could do was to threaten them with a civil penalty for being agent of a foreign power. And they had no other legal way of controlling them. Today, you have absolute control over anybody talking or doing anything and communicating with any of these groups.
Right,
that are on
those,
the terrorists.
Because they just designate them as terrorists.
They're designated as terrorists.
Like no real way to challenge it. And so that if you're doing what would have been legal in the 80s, hard to throw you in jail in the 80s. Today, there's very little left that you can do without them getting on your back, is what you're saying.
Margaret, can you explain what it means to be the target versus just getting a subpoena? Were these individuals targets themselves, or were they being called to get information about others?
It's very hard to predict or to say, because we don't know at this point whether they were targets or not. Generally, when you go into a grand jury, if you are a target, at least in the Southern District of New York, you're given a special additional target warning. So then you know that you're a target. I don't think any of the people who received subpoenas to the grand jury know whether they were targets or not.
How many people got subpoenas?
There were 14 subpoenas,
wow.
11 to individuals and 3 to organizations. But, of course, a subpoena to an organization takes a person to comply
to
with
to
the
it.
Subpoena.
So that's 15. Now, have all 15 been answered already?
Each of the 11 individual persons subpoenaed wrote letters to the Attorney General saying that they would assert their Fifth Amendment right and that they would not testify. And then that triggers the immunity issue. The Justice Department was not prepared. Sometimes the Justice Department is prepared with immunity orders immediately. Then you know that that's a clear hint that they want to put you in jail as quickly as possible. The immunity orders were not ready yet. So what happens at this point is that the local U.S. attorney is required then to go to Washington and have a discussion with the powers that be to discuss whether immunity should be given. And I think that's what's probably happening now.
We're speaking with attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler, an expert on grand juries, about the current subpoenas to movement activists in Minneapolis and Chicago.
Margaret, you mentioned that we didn't know, and I think that describes in general the grand jury process. It's rather secretive, isn't it?
Yes. One of the aspects of it that's so intimidating is that it is secret. If you go before the grand jury and refuse to testify, or let's say someone testifies partially or whatever it is, there's no way to know what that person said in front of the grand jury. So it's really kind of a very scary thing for the individual who goes before the grand jury, because people could think incorrectly that they were fingered or that somebody said something about them and that's why they were subpoenaed to a grand jury or that's why they were indicted. It's a very secretive process. You're not allowed an attorney into the grand jury room with you. An individual who testifies before a grand jury can discuss their own testimony outside of the grand jury, but that's the absolute extent of the possibility of exposing grand jury testimony.
Of course, when you're in the room, it's quite intimidating. You go in the room. Let's say I go into the room. Say Margie's standing outside. I go in front of the grand jury. They ask my name. I give my name. And then they ask me, Mr. Ratner, were you in Chicago August 2008? And I say, I want to go talk to my attorney outside before I answer that question. And my attorney has said, every question, come out and we'll discuss the question and you'll go back. I say, well, I want to go talk to my attorney. I said, they said, saying, what are you talking about? You're hiding something about whether you were in Chicago? You know, this is like looks bad for you. Or they'd browbeat you in the room. And let's say you're not an attorney like me, or let's say you're just, you know, a young person who's been put in there, they're going to browbeat the heck out of you. Hasn't that been some of your experience,
Margie? That definitely, you know, if you represent a witness before a grand jury, your main thing is to say, please, please, don't answer any questions. Come out with the question. It doesn't matter what excuse or how you're told that you must be hiding something. Say, you know, what I say is, say my attorney insists that I come out after every question.